The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The United States is ramping up its military aid to Ukraine with another $800 million worth of equipment being sent overseas. This includes heavy artillery, along with Javelin and anti-tank missiles.
There are signs of growing tension in Shanghai as the city enters its third week of COVID lockdown.
In one of the world's richest cities, residents scream, "Give us food." Last week, they were so hungry they ransacked a grocery store. In this apartment complex, a woman screams, "We are starving to death."
This warship that sunk in the Black Sea, how embarrassed do you think he is by that?
This is a very, very painful blow to the Russian Navy and the Russian Army. It's number one ship in the Black Sea fleet. It's the largest one. It is a ship that has been used by Putin personally all the time on all these Navy parades. And certainly it has a name, Moskva, the capital of Russia.
Department of Labor has released a stunning report showing the highest rate of inflation by far since 1981. According to the latest Consumer Price Index, inflation rose 1.2% in March. That's an 8.5% increase from the same time last year. Energy prices are a major contributor to the latest spike.
It seems, if you look at the latest Quinnipiac poll, the president's job approval rating stands at 33%. Those numbers are not good heading into a midterm election.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, this week, the news on inflation was so bad, it was good. At least that's the reaction we're reading from the financial markets to the news. And when it comes to investing, it's not the news that's important, but the reaction to the news. And this week, we got the release of the Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index for March. The data was bad, real bad. CPI rose 1.2% last month. And that's 8.5% year over year for headline inflation and up 6.5% for core, which is minus energy and food. This was the strongest print since early 1980s. Energy was the largest contributor to the year over year increase in inflation. And with no end to the Ukraine and Russia conflict in sight, it appears the inflation in energy prices may persist. The producer price index also rose a hot 1.4% in March, or 11.2% year over year. The second time the PPI was increased over 1% in a month. Reading some notes here from Ryan Sweet of Moody's Analytics suggests that while some supply chain stress has eased on the PPI, China's zero tolerance policy, which has led to province closures, suggests the supply chain pain could re-intensify. While there's growing unrest in China over the lockdowns, President Xi warned the country needs to stick to its strictest COVID approach while trying to minimize the economic pressures. This has helped to increase expectations of a required reserve rate cut by the People's Bank of China, possibly this Friday. So that was the news, but let's talk about the reaction to the news. Ahead of the CPI print Tuesday, the 10-year Treasury yield had hit 2.83% overnight. Yields fell after the announcement, down to 2.72, and then further down on Wednesday after the PPI print, down to 2.68%. The volatility index, up prior to the announcement, had fallen from a high of 25 down to 21. The thought process here is that in the coming months, inflation pressures will eventually ease because of the comparisons, hope for more supply chain easing, and demand destruction due to higher prices, and also due to the Fed tightening credit. The recent Fed minutes for the March meeting suggest the Fed is anticipating its quantitative tightening by allowing $60 billion in treasuries and $35 billion in mortgage-backed securities to roll off. That's almost double the rate of $50 billion a month in the last balance sheet reduction cycle from 2017 to 2019. As a result of a drop in rates, energy, technology, and consumer discretionary sector stocks had a major rally, but it didn't appear to have been enough to break the current downtrend this month in stocks. To end this week, retail sales missed expectations, up 0.5% for March, but when you take out gasoline sales, it actually fell 0.3%, which was pretty bad. Plenty of savings and credit available, in addition to abundant jobs and a tight labor market, are supporting strong demand, while rising prices and falling confidence serves to rein in some of those bullish forces. Additionally, historically low jobless claims and import and export prices up 12.5% and 18.8% respectively have helped to cause a sell-off in bonds again, driving yields back up towards their highs for the week. The 10-year Treasury finished up 14 basis points to 2.83%, and the 2-year jumped 11 basis points to 2.45%. Due to the tight labor and price inflation environment, a 50 basis point hike in May's Fed meeting, which I believe is May 4th, is pretty much baked into the cake. S&P 500 fell 2.13% this week, the NASDAQ fell 2.63%, and the Dow Industrials fell 0.78% to end on Thursday. To finish off the wrap-up, we should talk about earnings as the Q1 season kicked off this week. John Butters of FactSet wrote this week that 65% of S&P 500 companies are citing negative impact of labor costs and shortages on their Q1 earnings call, with about 20 companies reporting so far. He said at the end of Q4, 365 companies in the S&P noted inflation pressures on their call. That's likely to go up this quarter. COVID costs and supply chain disruptions were also high on the notes, in addition to raw materials, commodity prices, and transportation costs. How does this all translate to profit margins? Interestingly enough, John also wrote about that, talking about the blended net profit margin estimates are currently around 12.1% for the first quarter. And that's below last year's profit margin, which was at 12.8%, but it's above the 5-year average of 11.2%. So all in all, still in very good shape. But reporting this week, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup all beat earnings estimates, while JP Morgan missed. And the market really took some notes from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, who said that significant geopolitical and economic challenges are ahead, which seemed to tame the reaction to earnings overall this week in the other financials. That's it for this week's report. Next up, Mish Schneider, this week's technician.
In the short term, we expect the rate of change of inflation to decline. In other words, we think the 8.5% print from this morning is very likely to cycle peak. You know, could we be wrong? Yes, of course, but that's our expectation. Why? Well, first, the base effects get substantially harder starting in April as we start to really comp the reopening from last spring. That matters. But base effects aside, what about the fundamentals? Demand got a huge boost from massive fiscal stimulus, money printing. So you had demand way up, you had supply chains not working properly. What does that mean about the future? Well, are we going to see more consumer-oriented fiscal stimulus? No, probably not. Not with 8.5% inflation prints and divided Washington and so on. Are we going to see sustained reopening-like growth? You know, no chance. Sounds silly even saying it. We might even see the wealth effect reverse as the Fed tightens. So I think it seems pretty clear that the demand side is coming down.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the things about the news these days when it concerns the market, there is a plethora of stories going on, a lot of cross currents, which is what we're going to be speaking about this morning. Joining me on the program is Head of Trading and Research at MarketGauge is Mish Schneider. Mish, let's start with something you wrote about. Let's begin with what's going on in China. You know, we've heard one of their largest cities is in lockdown. What is that going to mean for the supply chain and costs? Why don't we begin with that?
First of all, in terms of numbers, Shanghai is really the area that's been shut down, which impacts about 26 million people. I think there's a couple of other places that are having a shutdown, which to us in the United States sounds enormous. But relative to the 1.3 billion people living in China, it's actually relatively small. However, Shanghai is a very influential and important city. And so what's happening there is they are having their own food scarcity problems, which they were having even before this latest COVID spin. And of course, they one probably the hugest importer of food because they have a lot of people to feed. In a situation where we've already had tremendous shortages of food for a variety of reasons. And in terms of finger pointing, it's really hard to say that it's anybody's fault when COVID happened, or that it's anybody's fault when Mother Nature decides to lay a hand and create a flood or severe drought. So we have kind of this perfect storm going on all over the world. And of course, now we had Ukraine-Russia situation where the food was already in shortage. And with all the commodities, the most important commodity, the one that none of us can live without, clearly, is food. So I've been hugely focused on this. And now what's happening with China is that even though demand may fall a little bit in terms of some of the other commodities, particularly energy, while they're in lockdown here in that small part of the populace, when they come back, the demand will just rise again. So demand will rise not just in energy, but again, more in food, but yet the supply is not going anywhere. So China has had their tentacles everywhere, trying to really basically get as much raw material from pretty much every country that has raw materials than they can. So it's no great surprise that they've been playing nice with Russia through this situation, even though the United States has kind of begged them to call out Russia for what's been going on. They haven't done that necessarily. And even before the Russia-Ukraine war, they were already very buddy-buddy. Xi and Putin were very close, along with Modi in India. And so essentially, if you put this all together, we have a food crisis that could get a lot worse, along with geopolitics that could get a lot worse. So it's not exactly a happy picture right now. And one would hope that cool heads ultimately prevail.
Well, let's talk a little bit further on this, because as a result of the war in the Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, you're seeing this kind of alignment of Russia and China. Now, India is coming into that sphere, and they're talking about taking delivery of oil in currencies outside the dollar. What does that mean for the petrodollar?
Well, some people would say that again, these are all issues that are being discussed, but there's been nothing conclusive yet. Now, of course, one of the biggest discussions is that this would actually really put the dollar as the world's reserve currency at risk. But other people say that's not going to happen because China does not really necessarily want to price petrol in yuan. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but essentially, I think it has a bigger implication, not just from a currency standpoint, but really what we can speak about that's happening partly as a result of this, which is this sort of deglobalization. And so that's really kind of what's going on, is that we're starting to get pockets. And now Europe is sort of stuck in the middle because they still need energy from Russia. And of course, with China taking a lot of the energy from Russia, Europe is in a situation now where they have a huge energy shortage, just like everybody else does. And their currency has just been collapsing. In fact, it collapsed even more today as they're trying to figure out what the hell their monetary policy should be. So getting back to the dollar and how petrol dollars are going to be priced in, I would say there's a chance that that changes, which would put the dollar in a very precarious situation, which of course would be disastrous for us. But my sense is that won't happen, or if it's going to happen, it won't be for quite some time, so we don't have to worry. And clearly, if you look at the dollar, my God, it's just been skyrocketing as a safety haven.
So, you know, the Fed is raising interest rates. We just got 8.5% inflation print. I think PPI is up 11% year over year. And it's hoped that in the second half of the year, as the Fed raises interest rates, that inflation will begin to moderate. But you just talked about a key factor here, deglobalization, which means, you know, as factories like Intel bring their factories back here, it's more expensive to produce goods here. So I see that as inflationary. We've got tight labor markets. And then on top of that, we've got energy where these companies, I don't care if it's OPEC or it's U.S. companies, have not invested in the sector over the last 6 to 8 years in terms of replacing reserves. And then here in my own state of California, we still have 100 ships offshore that can't be loaded. So we have supply chain issues. So will the Fed be able to tame inflation without wrecking the economy, given these more macro factors that are longer term in nature?
Well, Jim, you just very succinctly pointed out all of the issues that are involved with why this inflation peaked conversation that's being perpetuated strongly, by the way, by the Fed itself, is probably out of touch with the reality of everything that you're saying. I don't think the Fed can control it. I think they've already become so, first of all, non-credible. I mean, the credibility factor on so many areas of life are in question. I mean, everything from politics to government to science to media to banks. And so there you go. I mean, they kind of deserve their lack of credibility right now. They should have been doing this last year. You know, I was kind of rooting for it last year when the market was rallying. Come on, Fed, this is your time to strike. So, yeah, will they make a choice between the economy and inflation? I kind of think they already have. I think the reason why we're not seeing the market so much lower is because it seems like they are relaying that we're going to try to raise the rates by 0.5%, maybe 4 more times, but maybe not really. They're still robustly bond buying, even though they're talking about normalizing. They haven't really started a QT. I think they're more concerned about a recession than they are about inflation, because they actually believe, they believe that it's peaking or that it can't get much worse. Now, to support their argument, I will say this. Rate of change is extremely important. So far, the rate of change has been extremely high, right? We've just gone from, you know, what they consider to be, not just 2 years ago, zero inflation, to the target of 2% inflation. And now we're here, we are at 8.5%. So the question on rate of change now is going to be, do we go from 8.5 to 8.75 and back to 8.5? Or do we go from 8.5 to 11? And I'm assuming that the rate of change stays relatively stagnant. We go up a little, or we sort of normalize here at these high inflation. They're going to take that as a sign that it's peaked and not be so aggressive and not put us into a potential recession.
I want to talk about energy for a moment, and I want to begin with my own state of California. It's in the news today. California is going to pass a bill that would rule all gasoline cars in California. You won't be able to buy them after 2035. And we've got this green movement. We saw it in Europe. It backfired in Germany. We're doing the same thing in California. We're going to shut down our last nuclear power plant. So what I'm worried about, Mish, is at night when you've got your iPhone, your iPads, your laptops, and now your car charging, where's all this electricity going to come from when they're demanding that we go green, but we're not building stuff to replace it?
It's not funny, but it is kind of humorous, at least in sort of a sick way, because that is the question. You know, people don't really understand that you need fossil fuel, you need coal, you need natural gas, and then you need a whole lot of rare earth minerals, which are also, we were getting from China, mainly in short supply. And so you're right. Ultimately, I think this is going to be the way of the future. We will go alternative energy. We will go electric cars. I had envisioned anyway, you know, think the year 2035, maybe 2050, your gas guzzling cars are now, you know, antiques, that some amusement park opens up a place where you can go and drive your old gas car. And it's more of an amusement than a thing. I mean, you know, I think that's where we're heading. But right now we have so much to overcome to get there. And yes, idealistically, you can pass these kind of laws by 2035. But we know realistically, well, I was just in California. I mean, all I saw was Teslas. I have never seen so many Teslas in one place in San Diego as I had last week. But on the same token, I went into a couple of the electric car places and they said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't even have any cars. It's going to be like 3-4 months because of all the other things that you mentioned, supply chain, et cetera. So I'd say that this is why oil probably will go higher. I think there's like you say, credibility factor again, with, you know, well, gee, we're worried about the environment, but at the same time, we're killing the environment with all the stripping for the mines, by the way. I mean, that's not exactly environmentally friendly either. What do we do? What do we do? Where do we go? And ultimately, I think that we're going to go more electric. Clearly, that's the trend. and see what the cost is overall and do what we usually do, which is forge ahead and not necessarily think about the consequences until the consequences are staring us in the face.
It just seems to me that nuclear power, in fact, some of the new nuclear plants that you can build today, you can build them smaller, they're more efficient, they take less space than, you know, think of how much land is required to have a solar farm. Or, you know, I can tell you this, in California, we have the longest shore line in the country. You'll never see windmills offshore in Santa Barbara or Los Angeles. Just not going to happen.
No.
But it seems like the transition should be hybrids so that you can get better gas mileage. We're burning less fuel until we can get this thing figured out. But that's not what we're doing.
No. And by the way, that's a really good point because we sold, I had a Range Rover. We just sold it. It was a gas Range Rover. And so we've been looking at another car. And we live in a place, by the way, where outside of Santa Fe or Albuquerque, there's no charging stations. Plus, we just found out that if you have a car that isn't a Tesla, Tesla has the most charging stations, but your car, your electric car may not work with a Tesla charging station. So there's a real infrastructure problem outside of these major cities. We couldn't possibly get an electric car if we were planning to do any road trips. So we're going with a hybrid for the same logical choice that you just mentioned. Locally, we can go electric. Leave the city, we can go into gas. So yeah, I mean, it's getting back to the nuclear stuff. I have been sort of questioning myself for a long time, why aren't we looking at the cleanest energy of all, which is nuclear energy? And again, it's a massive hysteria about what happened with Three Mile Island and what happened in Japan and what happened, you know, in Russia. And, you know, so people look at that and they go, what if? It's, you know, it's like looking at a city and there's some crime, so therefore you're told not to go to that city, even though 97 or 98% of the time there is no crime. It's the same kind of thing. And that will probably have to shift at some point, whether it does or not, I couldn't even begin to guess.
You know, it's amazing. I have a nephew that has a Tesla. He lives in Arizona. He was driving to San Diego. When he got to Yuma, he had to go have lunch for almost an hour while his Tesla was being charged. And when he got to my house, he said he was desperate looking for an electrical plug to charge his car because it was just about empty on a charge. So now when he comes over, he drives his gas car for the very same reason you talk about. So you go out Albuquerque or Santa Fe, where are you going to charge your car?
Yeah, 310 to Yuma.
Well, listen, Mish, given what you see right now, from a trader's perspective, what looks attractive to you and what are you doing?
Well, we have basically hardly any equities on right now in our portfolios and even in our quant models. We had a few stocks that have done extremely well, like Vertex, for example, but most of our positions have been commodity-based, and that's across the board, whether it's in XME or XLE, or it's in natural gas, gold, silver. We've been in DBA and wheat. So we really are spread out in the commodity space. And about a week ago, I was thinking to myself, well, gee, I mean, I should have some equities in here. So we bought a little bit of biotech because I think that biotech is an interesting space because it's both a cyclical and a non-cyclical in that kind of like food, although people will forego medical care because they can, even if it's risky, before they'll forego food. But still, the second thing after food is medical care. And after COVID, I think people are trying to go back and get their health taken care of. So we've been in IBB. There's a couple of stocks within the IBB space are interesting, like Biogen. In the medical devices, there's Stryker. It's trying to hold here. But other than that, really, except for consumer staples, by the way, which we're in Petco. We were in XLP. We took some profits. There's really not a lot to look at equity-wise if we're going to go into another leg down, which I think it looks like it might happen. And one other thing I'm going to say, so I think you still can buy commodities on these dips. But the last thing I wanted to say about in terms of positions is VIX. I want to talk about VIX because nobody's talking about it right now. People are poo-pooing it and dismissing it as, oh, look at the volatility, it's so low. Well, there's such a discrepancy between the implied volatility and the discount that it's trading at right now compared to what's happening in the market. And so if you look at VXX, it's having what we, you know, what is called a golden cross. So for people who don't know what that means, it's when it's been in a downtrend, which it has been since the peak in March of 2020, right after COVID. It's been in this downtrend and now it's been consolidating, but at the same time, it's been consolidating, the 50-day moving average and the 200-day moving average have converged. And the 50 has gone over the 200 and the price is sitting right there. So that's a golden cross when the 50 clears over the 200 and it puts it now for the first time in 2 years more in a bullish phase while the price is sitting there. So that means one of two things. This is the greatest buy opportunity that I've seen in quite some time since natural gas, by the way, a couple of years ago, or the charts are lying and the market's going to go up and this will be a false breakout in terms of this golden cross. So we're in VIX. We're small position. We're either going to be wrong and get out quickly or we'll add to that position. And I think things can get really crazy if I'm right.
Well, I think you're probably right. Given all the macro conditions we discussed in this interview, it just makes for what I think future volatility, and the market, I think, is asleep to that right now. Mish, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at MarketGauge, how could they do so and follow you?
Well, so follow me. I always say the best place to go is Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter, and my handle is @MarketMinute. But to find out more about us, we have a website, marketgauge.com. We put out a lot of good daily content. We have a blog that goes out daily, another one that Keith Schneider does weekly, which is very extensive, talks about all the risk gauges. And you can learn more about our products there, our quant models and my discretionary service. And also, you can get my book, Plant Your Money Tree, A Guide to Growing Your Wealth. All of this comes to no surprise if you've read my book about how phases change and you get these counter trends and all of that, and then how to take advantage of that. So it gives you a good basic technical analysis place to start if you've never used charts before.
Well, thanks so much, Mish, for joining us. All the best to you, and please come back again.
Thank you, Jim. You have a wonderful weekend. Happy Easter.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we're committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939. Or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Along with rising interest rates lately, we've seen a rising dollar. What could that mean for corporate profits, especially since so many companies in the S&P get their sales from overseas? Joining me on the program is Mark Chandler. He's Chief Market Strategist at Bannockburn Global Forex. He's also the author of Making Sense of the Dollar and the Political Economy of Tomorrow. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. I'm looking at a series of interest rates. We've got, on the day you and I are speaking, we've got 10-year Treasury yields at 2.77. But, you know, looking around the globe, we're still one of the highest government bond market yields that you see globally. I mean, the only thing that comes close is Australia, maybe New Zealand, but everything else is far below us.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Beginning of this year, China offered 100 basis points, maybe a little bit more than that, on top of the U.S. And now for the first time since 2010, China is negative. That is, the U.S. has a premium over China. First time since 2010.
So, Mark, when you take a look at these kind of yields, and I don't think bond investors are, or maybe they are, beginning to realize how much you can lose in the bond market. I haven't seen yields climb this quickly in a long time. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that that in a higher interest rate environment, some measures of volatility in the bond market, like Merrill Lynch has this index called MOVE, which is sort of like the bond market equivalent to the VIX from the stock market, from the S&P 500. And we are seeing, as the markets adjust to this expectation now of not only higher interest rates, but higher inflation, that it's injecting this volatility into the market for sure. And I think that I think you're right as well, that we often think, and for regulators' purposes, oftentimes government bonds are regarded as a risk-free investment. But it's anything but that this year, huh?
You know, when you take a look at that, not only are they raising interest rates, but if you look at debt levels for all governments, I don't care if you're looking at Europe, you're looking at the U.S., Japan, and elsewhere. What does this mean, Mark, as they raise rates? Because I think overall the Treasury pays roughly about 2% on all its debt. What happens if, let's say, interest rates go up a full percentage point, as it looks like they're doing now, what that means for the government when it goes to refinance all that short-term debt?
Yeah, no, you're right, that the interest cost, how much it costs the U.S. government to service its debt is going to rise. But it needs to be kept in perspective in the sense that I think that the average maturity in the U.S. is about 7 years. So that's the part of the curve. And, of course, it is going to go up. But maybe the point really is that we were paying so little in these last several years when interest rates have been near zero. And so it is. So I think what you say is true. And that money is going to have to come from some part. And it's going to come from us. I mean, that's the only way the government raises money, right, is taxes and borrowing for it. So it comes to us either from our buying bonds as savers or comes to us as households on our taxes. I'm not sure, though, that it is the death knell of the economy or of the federal government spending. I think that, to me, the problem is that we are headed, it seems to me, for a dramatic slowdown of the economy. And the Federal Reserve has indicated there does seem to be a consensus having been forged that given the high inflation, and we're going to see it accelerate a bit more here, that given that the Federal Reserve, is that this consensus is moving toward a campaign, I think they've already launched it, toward bringing back the Fed funds rate to neutrality. And exactly what neutral means is not clear exactly because so many people on the Fed, so many different views. But in general, the majority of the Fed sees that neutral rate between 2.25% and 3%. I know it's kind of a wide range, but I think that is where we're headed. And if you look at the Fed funds futures contracts, that is what they're really saying is going to happen. This year, for example, the market is looking at the Fed funds futures. The market's saying that at the end of the year, the Fed funds rate will be 2.5%. And as you know, we're only at a quarter, right? Excuse me, we're at 50 now. So we're talking about 200 more basis points, which means that the Federal Reserve is going to be raising, it looks to me like two and maybe three times that they're going to hike by 50 basis points in this cycle this year. And to me, the worrisome is not just that Fed is tightening policy, but it's also that fiscal policy, and maybe this is part to your point, is fiscal policy looks like it's going to fall dramatically. That is to say that it's going to contract. You know, partly what's happening is that the government spending from COVID is fading and it's not being replaced very much. So what this means is that the budget deficit last year, the legacy of COVID, 10.8% of GDP. This year, economists, and this is a survey from Bloomberg, economists expect to fall to 5%. So we're getting monetary tightening in a magnitude that we haven't seen for a generation, 1980s. We're getting fiscal tightening we haven't seen for a generation either. And on top of that, we've got oil prices that have more than doubled. And typically, when oil prices double or more, it forces the U.S. into recession. So that's my concern is, I think you're right, monetary policy is tightening. We're going to be, as interest rates rise, we'll be paying more of our debt to service our old debt. And then you've got this fiscal contraction.
So when you look at this, you mentioned COVID spending. And in that COVID spending, the government was handing out helicopter drops. They were handing out checks to people. And so a lot of economists have said, well, the economy should hold up because consumers are flush with cash. that they've gotten from the government here in California. They're talking about handing out checks for gasoline for $400 just before the election. So as that stops, as rates rise, as inflation rises, gasoline prices rise, what kind of shape do you think the consumer is going to be in?
Yeah, I think that's the key, because, you know, it's us, consumers, that are 70% of the economy. So we're already seeing what seems to be a cost of living squeeze. I see the papers and at these conferences, people are talking about these large wage increases. And it's true that wages are going up, but they're not keeping pace with inflation. And so Americans are going to face a cost of living squeeze. And we're already beginning to see it in the retail sales report. We get another report in a few days. And here's what it looks like. People having to buy gasoline to fill up their cars, as well as heating their homes, could be air conditioning if you're lucky enough. And that is squeezing out what we call discretionary spending, the purchases of other goods. And so this is just, for me, this is just a squeeze on the consumer. Maybe it's the idea that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates until something breaks. Well, what's going to break first? I suspect it's going to be the consumer.
So as we look at this, you know, it's hard to believe, Mark, that a little over a year ago, you could get a 3% mortgage or even less. I have clients, have one client that locked in on 2.8%. Here we are close to 5%. So what impact will this have on housing? It's got to slow housing down, because that's a major jump in mortgage rates.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that we're going to begin seeing that as early as next week when we get the next batch of housing data. And that'll include housing permits, new starts, as well as existing home sales. And they all look weaker. So I think you're right. This is so in a raising interest rate environment, the interest rate sensitive sectors at first blush are most vulnerable. What is that? Housing and autos.
So let's look at something else. You know, the economy has been battered by COVID lockdowns over the last couple of years and all the different mandates that come out. We come out of that. Now we have this Russian-Ukraine war. Why don't you speak to the issues that arise from this? I'm thinking of what's happening in energy. Ukraine and Russia are major wheat exporters. You've got the president talking about food shortages. From your perspective, what do you see unfolding as a result of the war?
Yeah, I think you're right that there's three parts of that commodity complex, right? Energy, metals, and food. And they are rising. And so this is a difficult situation, because in some ways, it's like there's two blades. And one of them is the rising prices, and the other blade is growth. And so I think that the higher prices is going to slow down growth. And I don't know if stagflation is the right concept quite yet, but I think it's also global. And what the other danger, I think, that people fear about is that, you know, before we had the last big jump in food prices, exacerbated social tensions, and you had the Arab Spring in the Middle East. And I worry about that. Higher food prices just squeezes the people who are least able to afford it. And so that just means more social stress. And look what's happened in the last couple of weeks. Both in Serbia and in Hungary, the populist candidate, the center, sort of the rightist candidate, the more pro-Russian candidate won. And just over this past weekend, Le Pen gave Macron, the French president, a run for his money, and she drew the most amount of support that she's had. I think this is her third or fourth try at it. So I think that this is the danger, is that on one side, the sort of the established elite are talking about values. They're talking about democracy. And on the other hand, you've got this cost of living squeeze. It's alienating those people. And so I think that's really the tension, say, in Europe and in the U.S. And we'll see this continue to play out. That's what concerns me. I think that the war in Ukraine, I mean, some people say that Putin is crazy for doing what he's done. And yet I sort of see that 2008, he goes into Georgia, some sanctions, some whining, nothing really changes. 2014, he goes into Ukraine, he takes Crimea, people whine, sanctions, nobody changes anything. So why shouldn't he go to the cookie jar a third time? And he must be as surprised as anybody by how uniform, how widespread the sanctions are, including freezing the central bank's assets. stopping people, institutions from trading with the central bank. These are serious things, and I think that private sector participating in it as well. I think these are big things that are were unpredictable. No one would have imagined this kind of response. And so I think that it's going to be here for a while, the disruption, and partly what it means, I kind of think that, you know, you think about the Mackinder, the British historian's heartland theory, sort of like a game of chess, where the middle four squares are the most important. Not that you need to own them in a chess game, but controlling them is important. Same thing in Europe. This piece of territory, Central Europe, is the heartland. And Mackinder thought that if you control the heartland, you control the Eurasia real estate. And by controlling that, you control the world. And so our people, our species has been fighting over the same piece of land for generations, for hundreds of years. And it's probably not going to be resolved here. I think what we can hope for, though, is after Russia takes the part of Ukraine that seemed to take now, the breakaway provinces, that there can be, if both sides will find it in their interest to have a ceasefire. I know that the way the U.S. press reports it, that it sounds like Ukraine wants to negotiate, but Russia doesn't. But when Ukraine says some things like, we recognize now, belatedly, we're not going to join NATO, but we want a NATO country to guarantee our security. That's like a backdoor into NATO. It's a very transparent backdoor into NATO. It's not really a negotiating position. And so I think that Ukraine hopes for a military victory, and it's become, you know, the West and many allies in Asia sending Ukraine weapons. And the challenge here is that Ukraine's weapons that they currently have, they're used to their experiences with old Soviet Union weapons, different like millimeters of the caliber of bullets, for example, that they can shoot. Their railroad gauges are the same that the Soviet Union had, which don't dovetail well with, say, the train system in Western Europe. So there are some problems here, huh?
So looking at something that's coming out of the Ukraine, you've seen some of the Middle Eastern states, whether it's Saudi Arabia or some of the others, doing business outside the dollar. What happens to the petrodollar if more countries, let's say in the Middle East or even India, start trading in yuan or rubles? What does that mean for the dollar?
Yeah, you know, I see a lot of these concerns about this, and I think it's misplaced. Partly, I think that what's happened in our careers is that the capital markets are so much bigger than the market for goods, that is, for trade. Put this in perspective for you. Average daily turnover in the foreign exchange market is over $6 trillion a day. Global trade in a week, excuse me, global trade in a year is only about $30 trillion. And so that means that whatever moves the foreign exchange market, trade is probably a small part of it. When I try to understand where the currencies are moving, I tend not to focus on trade, especially for large economies like the US, Europe, China. I look at what drives the capital markets. And there, higher US interest rates, but it's also not just higher US interest rates, but really the breadth and depth of the treasury market. Now look what's happening today. The US government is trying to sell $46 billion. $46 billion of a three-year note. Tomorrow they go back to the cookie jar for 10-year notes, and then on Wednesday, 30-year bond. This is why the dollar has a key place in the world economy. Behind it stands not trade, which the U.S., as you know, runs a huge trade deficit and has been hitting record levels. But what stands behind the dollar is the depth and breadth of the treasury market, for which no other market is really comparable. The European bond market is much more like the U.S. muni market, where you have a bunch of small issuers with their own arcane rules. So I think if someone's going to move out of treasuries, they're going to be giving up yield, they're going to be giving up security, they're going to be giving up liquidity. And so I'm not, if the Saudis sell oil to China and they let China pay them in RMB, does that really make sense from a Saudi point of view? Why would the seller let the buyer choose which currency? And even if they do choose which currency, what is Saudi Arabia going to do with the renminbi? They peg their currency to the dollar. So when the U.S. raises interest rates,
Saudi Arabia has to raise interest rates. And that's what they did when the Fed raised interest rates recently. And they're going to have to continue to do so. So I don't see changing which currency you pay me in. And I'm also going to benchmark the oil that I sell to China in dollars. And so if they want to pay me the renminbi equivalent, that's one thing. But the dollar is still, dollar doesn't go away. And I think that the key to the foreign exchange market, especially for the major countries, is not really about trade. I want to say that's like an early 20th century or 19th century approach. I think that the more cutting edge is really still looking at capital flows, not trade flows.
So, Mark, as we sum this up, as you look at this market, we've got rising yields. We've got the Fed in aggressive rate raising mode to try to squash or at least contain inflation. And we've got a rising dollar, which is not good for corporate profits. As an investor, what would you be doing here?
Well, I'll tell you what I like. The U.S. Treasury has issued in the past, as you know, inflation-linked securities, inflation-linked bonds. They say, you're worried about inflation? Let the government absorb the inflation. Lend us your money. Well, that product is now available to retail investors. You can buy it directly from the Fed, directly from the Treasury. iDirect, it's called an iBond. And there's some restrictions to it. That is, household. It's not meant to cater to very wealthy people. It's more for the average American. Maximum $10,000 a year. But what's interesting about it is that bond, that iBond that you can buy, that inflation-protected security, is yielding 7.1%. 7.1% from the government. The U.S. 10-year bond is about 277 right now. The 30-year bond is about 285. And I'm suggesting that iBond, from people who rising interest rates, bad for stocks, you say a stronger dollar hurts corporate earnings. Where could people park some money and hold on and preserve its purchasing power? I like that iBond, inflation-protected security, retail investors, $10,000 a year per person maximum, but it yields 7.1%. That 7.1% will get re-examined, reset next month for another 6 months. And because inflation's rising, that 7.1% was also likely to go up. So I like the iBonds as a place to park money until we get further along into this Fed tightening cycle, maybe towards the end of this year, early next year.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, just before we do, tell our listeners about your latest book, The Political Economy of Tomorrow.
Sure. Thanks. That sounds kind of weird, someone from Wall Street saying this, but I begin off with the premise of someone who worked at Brown Brothers Harriman, where I work, but 100 years before me, a guy named Charles Conant. And he thought that the problem that America faced then was too much savings, too much money, too much capital. And he suggested that the U.S. basically helps other countries build out their infrastructure. Sounds familiar? Sounds to me like it's President Xi from China's Belt Road Initiative that the U.S. invented, came up with at the last part of the 19th century. So I look at the implications of what this could mean of surplus capital. And you know, even as we sit here today, there's over $1 trillion of negative yielding bonds, mostly in Europe and Japan. So I looked at this. I used this guy, Charles Conant, as sort of my protagonist. I just try to follow the logic of what it means when we have too much of things. And I think ultimately my story is like a King Midas story. You know, remember King Midas from the Greek mythology? Whatever he touched turned to gold. It sounded good when he would touch a tree, but then he tried to drink some wine and hug his daughter. And I think we're in the same condition. We're choking on our own successes.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I keep a blog on Mark to Market, Mark with a C, makes my mother happy, marktomarket.com. I post something every day of the week. And I'm also have a Twitter handle, Mark Making Sense. And that comes from that book title you mentioned, Making Sense of the Dollar.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Stay well and come back again.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.